Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, we have a very exciting show for you in the most intellectual and platonic way possible about robot sex dolls. Professor John Danaher joins us. He's authored a book called Robot Sex, Social and Ethical Implications. We'll get into it with me and my co-host Stefan Spida next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Stefan Spida. Episode 432, recorded August 31st, 2018. Freeing Frigid Farah. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We've got a really exciting episode of This Week in Law in store for you this week. My co-host, Stefan Spida, is here. Hello, Stefan.
Hello, Denise. Glad to be back.
Well, I hoped we would be able to keep things interesting for you as you come into your term as co-host of This Week in Law with me. And this week, I think we're delivering on that promise because our guest this week is John Danaher, who's a lecturer at the Law School of the National University of Ireland in Galway, where his scholarship focuses on legal philosophy and the future of machines and humanity. He has written a book called Robot Sex, Social and Ethical Implications. Hello, John. Great to have you on the show.
Well, thanks for inviting me, and I look forward to discussing this no doubt salacious topic for a Friday morning.
Yes, definitely, or Friday evening in your part of the world. We very much appreciate your scholarship and your authoring this book. We think it's obviously a fascinating topic, and it seems to be it's very timely, I think, for us to discuss it right now, because we seem to be getting to a point in this industry where, you know, you've read the sort of headline grabbing stories before, but it's really becoming a real marketable thing. So let's get right into it and talk about these particular kinds of robots. Am I right, John? Are we hitting a sort of tipping point where these things are not just novelties, but they might be more widely available than folks are used to?
Well, I mean, widely available might be pushing it a little bit, but there certainly are a number of companies that have created prototype models, and they are looking to market and sell them to the public. So, yeah, I think we've gone beyond the realm of pure science fiction into something that's a little bit more tangible and real at this point in time. So, yeah, I think it is a timely point to discuss this.
Why don't we start out by defining what exactly we're talking about here? Because there are different iterations of synthetic companions available on the market today. Some of them are more artificially intelligent than others. Can you sort of tell us what the landscape looks like?
Yeah, and I think this is a tricky thing as well, because when people talk about sex robots, this might immediately conjure into their minds the image of some famous, you know, science fiction movies where you have incredibly human-like or lifelike robots that can talk and act like a human being. That's not exactly what we're talking about at the moment. What we're talking about at the moment really is a step up from a sex doll, which obviously has been around for a very long time. Mm-hmm. We're talking about something that probably has some degree of artificial intelligence, and that can be quite limited. You know, they might have pre-programmed verbal responses or conversational prompts, and might have some degree of human-like movement and touch. So my general definition of what a sex robot is it's basically an artificial embodied agent with some degree of human-like movement, human-like touch, and human-like intelligence, which could be quite limited, that is designed and used for the purposes of sexual gratification.
There is one California company I've seen in the news quite a bit. That is the real, they make the Real Dolls line of customizable sex dolls, and they are about to start shipping their product next month. But yeah, far from the only game in town.
Yeah, so I mean, Real Doll are—they're probably the biggest player in this particular market. Real Doll has been around for, I think, 20 years or so, since the mid '90s, making these highly realistic, customized sex dolls. And now they are adding effectively an animatronic head with an artificially intelligent assistant that you can talk to, called Harmony. So it's the Harmony sex doll. It's effectively got like Siri-like or Google Assistant-like conversational engagement with this head that moves, and there's some facial gestures and articulations. But we're not talking about something that can stand up and walk around your living room or anything like that.
I mean, thank goodness, I guess. But at some point, we will be talking about that, won't we?
Yeah, I should mention as well, there are a couple of other companies that are doing this. If people are really interested in the nitty-gritty of the competitive race to create the world's first sex robot, there's a website called futureofsex.net that keeps an updated web page on all the companies that are doing it at the moment. So there's another Spanish company called Cynthia Amatus, run by a guy called Sergey Santos, who's done quite a bit of media in the UK and Europe about his sex doll called Samantha. And there was also another company quite a number of years ago called True Companion, who claimed that they had the world's first sex robot, and they displayed it at a trade show in Las Vegas back in 2010, I think. This is a True Companion a sex robot called Roxy. I will say that there's a little bit more skepticism in the community about whether they actually have a properly functioning prototype and whether anyone has bought one or uses it. Some people think that the claims that the manufacturer makes about the sophistication of that device are overstated.
A little bit like the bad blood Theranos allegations that overpromised and underdelivered.
Probably need to be a little bit careful about this, since I don't want to misrepresent the product. But effectively, there are no known purchasers or users of the product.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and
even though it's
so
been available for 8 years, whatever.
Right. So we've got some that are, you know, have some movement, have some interaction. The Real Dolls ones will actually speak to you. There are plenty of videos of these things online if you're interested in seeing exactly what their marketing materials look like. I also saw, I happened to be flipping through channels, and 2 Chainz does a show on the Vice Network called Most Expensivest, where he went to the Real Dolls headquarters. And it's very, very entertaining to watch him walking through the very surreal looking dolls hanging from hooks on the ceiling and getting ready to ship out. They are not cheap either. They start in the few thousand dollars range. And there's one person interviewed in a CNET piece that we have in today's discussion points who spent $17,000 on his. So they are equal opportunity, I guess, is what I'm striving for there. You can buy a male or a female or various iterations of your desired companion. And they're very, very customizable, apparently, this particular one. So we've got that sort of landscape going on. I read about one getting ready for the show today that is just a like a torso and a head. I think this one is being made in the UK, and it's literally sort of the sexy version of an Echo device. And I suppose as you say, John, it's designed to have various less pragmatic interactions with you, but it'll do things like buy your groceries, etc. But here's where we start getting into sort of the legal, ethical ramifications of all this. This particular one, when you speak to it, responds with things like, "Yes, master." Have you seen this one?
I haven't seen that particular one, but you put me in mind of another example, which I would encourage people to look up. There's a a YouTube video you can watch where it's called, and it's not in any way unsafe for work as well, by the way. It's mm-hmm. a Japanese company called Gatebox. They make something called Azuma Hikari, which is effectively like a projected virtually intelligent domestic housewife. It's kind of catering to this 1950s ideal of what a housewife would be, and has a lot of that kind of language within it as well.
Right.
Yeah. So I recommend checking that out. It's an interesting product, and the ad that they've created for it is quite interesting and raises then a bunch of ethical questions about the kinds of scripts that these devices use and the norms and attitudes that they're reinforcing towards women or concerning sexual relations as well. So,
right. Sort of the biggest problem we're struggling with in our interactions with personal assistants in today's world is whether you say please and thank you to them or you teach your children to, when something is saying, designed to be subservient to you, that's raising a whole other ethical, moral, social kind of problem. Stefan, what do you think of all this? And any questions before we, as we're sort of setting the stage for what we're looking at before we start talking about the problems that they create?
The subservience point made me laugh a little bit because, one of the reasons I don't have a dog and don't want a dog is the thought of having a living creature that I have to command and enter into this sort of master servant relationship with is so disturbing to me that I don't want to interact with anything in that way, and the thought of having a robot that is subservient to me, it makes me feel just queasy, and I have to fight that moralizing instinct that it arises in me, because I don't want to universalize it and try to treat it as this principle that's universally bad, but at the same time I can't deny that it makes me feel a little bit queasy to think about that kind of scalable subservience. So my question, I guess, would be, as someone who has access to this community and researches it carefully, do you find that there's a sophisticated discussion going on about that problem of subservience and what that says about the people who are purchasers of these products? Or is that something that's not currently front and center in the discussion?
Yeah, so my access or engagement with the community of people who create these devices and are interested in maybe using or purchasing them is reasonably limited. So the company that I mentioned earlier on, the Spanish company, Cynthia Amatus, Sergey Santos runs that. He is very much tuned into some of these ethical debates and is interested in creating a sex robot that is capable of consenting, for example, or at least mimics consent, so it's not a purely subservient act, and that it will somehow reinforce more positive norms relating to sexual consent. There's obviously a very active debate about this in academia, which I'm much more familiar with, and there are people arrayed on both sides of this. So Joanna Bryson, who's a well-known AI ethicist and computer scientist in the UK, has written a paper a number of years ago which basically argues that robots should be servants. That we shouldn't create person-like robots that we might be inclined to apply these human-like attitudes or emotions towards, or that we think we should be in some kind of relationship of equality with. And then there are other people who are very much aligned on the opposite side of that, who think it's perfectly acceptable to create person-like robots. There's a range of views out there. Sergey Santos, who I have had a little bit of interaction with online, seems to be somebody who is kind of tuned into these ethical debates. I think Matt McMullen from Real Doll is also sensitive to some of these debates, but I don't know him as well.
John, as someone who studies philosophy and ethics and thinks a lot about these issues, do you have an opinion on that front, how we should interact with not just our robot sex dolls, but our robot assistants of all kinds?
I do have an opinion on it, but it's an opinion that is not widely shared, so it's a little bit extreme, my view. So my view is something that I would call ethical behaviorism, which effectively holds that if a robot looks and acts in a human-like way, then you ought to treat it as if it were a human, even if you don't know that it is human, or you assume that it has no inner mental life or inner consciousness, you should still act as though it does. And so standard behavioral norms tend to apply then.
But that's more for your own health and society's health than its health, correct?
My view probably takes a long time to set out, but roughly, yes, it's for your own health and for society's health, but it is also partly on the grounds that we don't actually know whether, we don't have access to whether other human beings are conscious, their inner mental life. We only ever have to go on their external representations or behaviors towards us. And so my view is that there can be effectively a parity between artificial devices and humans at a certain level of behavioral sophistication. So I wouldn't argue that robots are currently at that level of behavioral sophistication, but once they are at that level, then you ought to treat them with the same kind of moral respect that you owe to a human being.
And as long as we're talking about big sort of pie in the sky issues, there are a lot of people who think it's inevitable that artificial intelligence will cross a singularity into a realm where it's a truly free thinking intelligent entity, where that is possible. And certainly in that kind of situation, you would hope that law and ethics and policy would evolve to supply some sort of framework for that doesn't exist now. What do you think of that?
You know, there are some kind of early stage discussions of this in mm-hmm. Europe. The European Parliament issued a widely reported study on civil liability rules for robots a few years ago, where they argued that we should take seriously the idea of electronic personhood and ascribing some kind of legal personhood to sophisticated, artificially intelligent robots. Good bit of pushback against that. So we have some of that conversation already ongoing. If robots do cross the threshold into being artificially intelligent and the equivalent or even surpassing humans, then I think, of course, the same kinds of ethical norms should apply to them as apply to other human beings. But I guess my point is it's a little bit more philosophical and subtle. It's just that I'm not sure that we can ever know whether another entity meets all the conditions of personhood that philosophers usually appeal to, such as whether they're sentient and whether they have some kind of continuing life narrative or identity, some sense of personhood. We never actually have access to that information. We only ever have access to how they behave and represent themselves towards us. So I think that robots and humans can be equivalent in terms of their representations.
Right. I guess see also Blade Runner. Okay, so let's get back to talking about the current world and technology of sex robots and sort of how they're manifesting themselves among us. These people that are manufacturing them are charging a pretty penny for them. So I suppose that there is a large portion of the customer base that are wealthy or saving up to purchase one of these things and have it in their own home. But I mean, particularly because of the expense, it occurs to me that someone might, you know, form a business around this, take out loans or get investments. And in places where, first of all, okay, I'm getting around to the fact that someone would make a sex doll brothel, and somebody already has. Apparently, there's one in Spain, in Barcelona.
I kind of follow these stories from time to time, and they crop up, but it's very much a moving field, so it's hard to keep on track of it. As far as I recall, the one that was opened in Barcelona was shut down maybe a couple of weeks later due to some sort of health and safety violation. It may have reopened subsequently. There have been companies in South Korea and Japan who have kind of done rent-a-sex doll services for quite some time. And there are a number of people who speculate that this will be the more realistic business model when it comes to this technology because, as you mentioned, the expense of these devices, certainly once you get to the more sophisticated end of things. Somebody raised this to me recently in a conversation. You know the Asimo robot? I think they now shut down this program. Somebody mentioned to me that that costs a couple of million dollars. So, you know, not everyone's going to be able to buy one of those to have in their home. So some kind of rental service or Uber for sex dolls or something like that is going to be more likely, I suspect.
Right. Well, and then the other way in which a sex doll brothel is an Uber for the sex worker industry is the sex workers themselves are not happy about this. It's competition. And so that's one regulatory legal concern that may come into play is even though the sex dolls are expensive, they're far cheaper and far, I guess, easier to manage from an employment standpoint than an actual human would be. So I'm sure that, sex workers themselves are not thrilled about this development. There is an article that I will put in our discussion points for today. It's not there yet. That talks about, you know, the sex workers pushing back on this. The Association of Sex Professionals slamming what is called in this piece a flourishing business. Saying that sex dolls can never recreate the intimacy provided by humans. But all of that sort of strikes me as, you know, a bit reminiscent of cab drivers and other folks with a lock on an industry saying, hey, don't come in and disrupt our industry and provide a cheaper way to do the same thing. The other thing that really strikes me as interesting about this concept is if a brothel is illegal, that's because prostitution is illegal, and prostitution, I would assume, is defined to involve paying a human being to provide you with sexual services. Is it even prostitution? Is it even a brothel under most legal definitions of that? Have you worked through any of that, John?
Can I just say one thing about the kind of the how sex workers feel about this development?
Sure.
That was actually my first entry point into this debate and discussion. I wrote a paper about sex work and technological unemployment about 5 years ago at this point in time. So it was the very first thing I wrote about sex robots. And in that paper, I was making the argument or considering the argument that sex work will be subject to the same kinds of technological disruption as other forms of labor. But I also suggested that it might be slightly more resilient to technological disruption on the grounds that technological unemployment in other industries is likely to proceed at a faster rate than it will in relation to kind of sex labor or sex work. And also that...
but it probably won't get as much coverage, right? Because it's more fun for reporters to write about sex dolls than it is for, you know, the robot in the car manufacturing plant.
Yeah, but the other point that I was thinking about was that as unemployment proceeds apace in other industries where humans have no obvious or discernible advantage over machines, human workers will have to flock to industries in which there is some kind of perceived advantage over machines, which will typically be kind of service-type related industries where you think there's some importance to a human-to-human contact. And sex work might be one of those industries that humans flock to in the face of technological unemployment in other industries. That was the main argument in that paper. But I mean, to go back to your point about prostitution, the suggestion is that, you know, in countries like Korea and Japan, the renting out of sex dolls occurs as a way of avoiding the regulations in relation to prostitution. The thing I would say is that in most countries, the act of prostitution is not illegal itself. The actual purchase or selling of sex is not illegal. What's typically illegal are activities that are connected to or related to that, such as running or managing a brothel. And the definition of what a brothel is in law that I'm familiar with is it has to be two or more people in the same building or premises who are selling sex. And obviously, if you have, you know, one person with a bunch of robots or a bunch of dolls, rather, that would seem a way of kind of avoiding that legal definition of what a brothel is. So I imagine that this is being done on the grounds of avoiding the regulation of sex work in many countries. However, as the Spanish case illustrates, I think there will be an attempt to use other kinds of laws or regulations to clamp down on these businesses, such as health and safety laws or some other kind of public, I'm trying to think, so, you know, some kind of breaching of public morality or some obscure laws like that. Actually, to give another illustration of the way in which lawmakers can creatively use the law to clamp down on this, we might have talked about this later in more detail, but when it comes to things like child sex dolls and child sex robots,
yes,
which we people will are definitely very concerned about. In the UK, they clamp down on the importation of child sex dolls into the country using an obscure law from 1844, I think, which bans the importation of obscene objects. Mm-hmm. Which is still on the statute books, and they suddenly kind of revivified it a couple of years ago to clamp down on this industry.
Right. I definitely want to get into that in more detail in just a bit. But while we're still sort of setting the stage here, I'm curious, just as a final legal overlay, if you know if there are any countries that have decided, well, for example, China strikes me as a place where they might be skeptical of allowing these things for sale to the public, even though I think many of them are made there. But I haven't researched whether they're legal there or not. And I'm wondering if you know, John, if there are countries that have just flat out said, nope, we are not a sex doll friendly place. Don't sell them here.
No, the only country I know of that's doing that is the U.S. at the moment.
Okay. Yes, and then the way in which we're regulating one specific part of the industry that you you mentioned, and we'll get into that in a moment. Stefan, any final questions about laws or regulations of prostitution or the sales of these items in general?
Yeah, one clarification. So we're referring to these as sex robots in the general topic involves sex, but I noticed that in the marketing materials and in some of the videos that they use the word companionship, and I'm wondering whether that's a euphemism or whether really what we're talking about is a technology that's progressed to the level of sort of awkward AI conversation with a quasi-lifelike robot, but not actual sex, or whether we actually have technologically gotten to a point where it is intended for people to have intercourse with these robots. And that, I guess that's one clarification that would be interesting to set the stage here as we go deeper into the topic.
Well, I think when we're talking about effectively dolls with maybe some sort of conversational chatbot type interface, the intention or the assumption is that people will be having intercourse with the doll, whether it's meaningful to say that they are having sex with the doll is a separate question or a separate issue. But I think the idea is that people will be engaging in sexual acts with these dolls. That said, I mean, your point about companionship is an interesting and important one. I think if you look at interviews with people like Matt McMullen and again, Sergey Santos in Cynthia Amatus, they are very keen on the idea that these are not just sex toys or sex dolls, that they are a new form of companionship and that people will have loving and intimate relationships. And they often state that as being one of the main reasons why they want to create these devices, because it's not just about sexual gratification or sexual release. It's about something more. It's about achieving some kind of artificial intimacy.
And this part of our discussion is reminding me of the Aibo robot dog, Stefan. Maybe that could be a starter pet for you. see how you feel about having Aibo in the house.
Did you ever have a Tamagotchi, Stefan?
I did not. Well, maybe I did for about a week, but like the plant that you see in the background there, it probably didn't stay alive for very long.
very good.
Exactly. All right, so let's move on to another topic of interest about sexual companions of robotic or doll form, and that would be privacy. John, I'm wondering if in your research or reading about the people designing and selling these things, if you've seen any touting of their GDPR compliance.
So I haven't, and that's an important and interesting question. So it seems like, obviously, if you're selling one of these devices into a European market anyway, you'll have to be GDPR compliant at the moment. So I'm guessing Sergey Santos for Cynthia Amatus will have to be GDPR compliant. And again, Realdoll, if they're selling into the European market, will have to be GDPR compliant. But I haven't seen much discussion of that. It's something that's under-discussed, but there might be a good reason for it being under-discussed insofar as it's not obvious that sex dolls or robots themselves raise any kind of new issues in relation to privacy. Privacy is across the board with sex technology and also digital technology more generally. So there are obviously people might be more sensitive when it comes to sexual privacy, but I'm not sure if it raises any kind of newer distinctive concerns when it comes to privacy.
Well, I guess.
But you might disagree with that. Yeah, so.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends how they're designed. We did a story on the show a couple of years ago, maybe several years ago now, that involved a controversial sex toy that was not a robot, but that was Wi-Fi enabled. And that apparently without advising its users and getting consent was sending reports back to the home front of, you know, various usage, whatever, how it's functioning. Who knows what data it was sending home, but it was sending data home and people were not happy to learn that. And so I just wonder if that has come up. No, God, there it goes. This is going to be a really hard show not to pun our way through. Stefan and I were saying before the show, I wonder if this is an issue that has been confronted by people in the industry. Obviously, they want to make these things as technologically advanced and cutting edge as possible. And I'm sure that for many manufacturers, yeah, either existing now or going into the future, having some sort of life that exists online and data collection that happens around it will be something that they want to do.
Yeah, I mean, so obviously there have been a couple of cases involving, you know, these smart sex toys, which have settled, I think, out of court for people whose data was being collected without their awareness. And you're probably familiar with these cases. I think they were both in the US, as far as I recall. Mm-hmm. And so my point is just that if people are concerned about Facebook collecting their data, then it seems to me that they should obviously also be concerned about smart sex toys and sex dolls collecting their data. And I suspect kind of similar approach might apply. Similar legal provisions might apply. So it's not clear to me that you need a new set of laws to deal with sexual privacy. I mean, I guess the conversation in Europe is maybe a little bit different as well to what it's like in the US, given that we've kind of gone through the cycle of drafting and introducing the GDPR, and now it's up and running, and we're seeing how effective or ineffective it is. Whereas in the US, I guess things are a little bit less developed on that front.
Right. And I'm kind of wondering from a practical standpoint, how the consents would be gathered in this kind of situation, you know, using a computer or a phone or a tablet, you're going to gather consent by some sort of pop-up window. I wonder if, you know, if one of these things is gathering information or data or needs your consent to be GDPR compliant, if it's just going to ask you for it and how that gets documented. And we really don't have any. Yeah. We're at the cutting edge of these things being actually out in the world and part of society. So there's not much to talk about here, except that it will be interesting to see if the manufacturers pay attention to these issues and, you know, look for the lawsuits.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. As far as I understand, like the Harmony Realdoll robot is going to be a cloud-based AI. So presumably it is going to collect data about its users and send it to some remote server. Mm-hmm. And I think it is paired with an iPhone app or a smartphone app. So I'm guessing there's probably going to be some consent form on that. And you know, how seriously do people take it when it when these pop-up windows about consent arise. Just speaking from my own experience with the introduction of the GDPR, you know, every news website, particularly ones in the US that I now look at, will have a pop-up window that I have to agree to cookies and the collection of data. Obviously, I was aware of that happening being the reality before, but now I have to explicitly consent to it. And the first couple of times it happened, I did look into my privacy settings and tried to tweak them. But then it was just so frequent an occurrence that I basically clicked on everything. I'm wondering then, you know, if people learn that default consent attitude towards the Facebook or news websites or whatever, how will they approach sex technology and sex dolls? I'm guessing maybe people are a little bit more sensitive and concerned about privacy in that area, so they might be less inclined to just default towards the manufacturer's data collection policy or preferences.
I'm thinking, heck yeah, because, I mean, people have been really uncomfortable with the notion that Amazon's devices, for example, are partially recording or keeping in a buffer what's being said in a room in order that they can interact and respond when summoned with their wake word. You know, if a internet-connected AI is partially there so that a device can interact with you in real time, and this device is intimately involved in one of the most intimate aspects of human existence, you could just imagine how creeped out people are going to be by, having a relationship with this inanimate device and it's recording every bit of it. So I think that there will be sensitivity around that. What do you think, Stefan?
I take the point about not necessarily requiring new laws to account for the framework of how the privacy issue is litigated or addressed through legislation. I think the framework is probably the same whether you're talking about which websites you're visiting or how you're using a sex toy. I think that the idea that the issue is the same downstream from that, I think, is maybe wrong, because depending on what country you're in, sexual norms may be legislated differently, and so your privacy and your sexual preferences might matter less if you're living in Europe or parts of the United States. Other countries, it may matter a lot more than which websites you're visiting. And I think that's part of what's interesting about a lot of these issues when you talk about technology, is that the technology can move pretty freely across borders, but the context in which it is used can vary tremendously. And so I don't know if I would go so far as to say that the privacy issues involving sexual matters are quite the same as those involving morally neutral activities that aren't quite subject to the same level of scrutiny across borders. So,
right. And I think you have to think about who you're entrusting your data to as well. I think people might feel one way about an Amazon or a Google personal assistant. They might be, you know, sufficiently creeped out about that. But if something like this is just laying around part of your home decor, and you know, with are any of them equipped with cameras that you know of, John?
I'm not sure if they're equipped with cameras.
I mean, yeah. It's comforting that you don't just automatically say, oh yeah, they are.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, like, how the animatronic head in Harmony works, because that's probably the most sophisticated one. I'm not sure. I mean, let me just say one thing, that I've shifted my view now on this topic in the last 5 minutes. You are correct, of course, that the privacy harms that could arise from an unwanted or unwarranted disclosure could be much greater in the case of sexual privacy. Mm-hmm. And you know, the experience of services like Grindr in countries where homosexuality is still illegal testify to that problem and that the importance of being sensitive to that issue. I mean, one reason why I think we should take why privacy is important is because it's a protection against the kind of moral imperfection and intolerance of the rest of the world. You know, one reason why the kind of claim that, well, if you've got nothing to hide, why you care about your privacy one reason why that argument isn't a good one, I think, is because, well, one reason to be concerned is that other people might be much less tolerant of your worldview or your approach to life, even though it's perfectly morally acceptable in most people's eyes. So, and that's a good reason. And people are particularly sensitive to that when it comes to their sexual lives. So, yeah, I think I should change my opinion and say that there are fairly significant and important privacy harms when it comes to the collection of data about sex life.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think if I were one of these companies or advising one of these companies, I would tell them to get way out in front of that issue and try and be very data privacy sensitive and to market themselves, you know, distinguish themselves that way. Any final thoughts on privacy considerations, Stefan?
Yeah, the other interesting thing about this is, you know, you think about anyone who's ever lived in a small town and then moved to a big city, there's an anonymizing effect that happens there. And you get out from under the scrutiny of a tight-knit community that knows everything about you and may judge the way that you behave. In a funny way, technology, for how sophisticated it is, can help render even big cities small towns again by making people much more aware of what you're doing and in a much better position to then respond to you for your choices and in some way control them. And so when I think of privacy, I think of it as the freedom to be anonymous to a certain extent. And as we collect data about behavior and then put that into a feedback loop that then allows the holders of that data to target the people who are generating it and augment their behavior, it's a little bit like living in a small town where everybody knows your business. And that loss of freedom around anonymity is partially what I find disturbing about privacy. And I think in the sexual context, that is probably the starkest representation of that particular issue. So I find it interesting that on the one hand, these developments would not be possible were it not for a certain loosening of moral I was going to say moral standards, but that's not quite what I mean. A certain openness to advancing what we consider moral and immoral. But the effect, if it's not done responsibly, could be to regress into an environment where everybody is under a kind of scrutiny that they would rather not be under. And so my hope is that as this technology develops, that people are thinking about, you know, what are we giving away here and what conditions are we imposing on ourselves by sharing this information?
Yeah, it's a good point. And there's a famous Irish novel called The Valley of Squinting Windows, which is about that, you know, small town mentality, the sense that everyone knows your business and is looking at you. And I guess the web and digital technology can recreate that value of squinting windows on a much larger scale.
Yes, good points, gentlemen. All right, let's make that our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, namely Valley of Squinting Windows. We put these phrases into our show in case you are a lawyer or other professional and you are listening to or watching the show. Certainly, we hope, because it's interesting and you enjoy getting together with us in general, but also because we talk about issues that can help you in your professional life. So if you are in a field where compliance with continuing legal education or other kinds of professional education are a thing, maybe you're watching or listening to the show partially for that purpose. So we put these phrases in because some oversight bodies like to be able to actually have some palpable proof that you watched or listened and didn't just write down episode 432 of This Week in Law on a piece of paper or e-form somewhere. So Valley of Squinting Windows is our first phrase, and we'll put another one in before the end of today's show. If you are a lawyer in the United States, you can head on over to our show's wiki at wiki.twit.tv/find our This Week in Law page there. I'm not going to try and give you the long URL. But if you do go over there, you'll find a chart of the various jurisdictions in the United States and some forms that we have found to be useful or might be useful in your jurisdiction to be able to start that process. All right, let us move on and talk about Some of the more problematic portions of the realm of robot sex. All right, let's get right to what you raised earlier, John. The fact that, as far as we know, the only law against robotic sexual companions or sex dolls that we know of, and I haven't looked at this proposed legislation in the U.S. to know if it cares how artificially intelligent the thing might be or not. Here in the United States, there is an act that has passed Congress. It passed Congress in June, and now it's up to the Senate to decide if the Creeper Act is going to be the law of the land in the United States. I'm looking to see if I can find what the acronym stands for. Curbing Realistic Exploitive Electronic Pedophilic Robots Act, Creeper. And as John mentioned before, this is aimed at preventing the sale of sex dolls that resemble or are intended to resemble children. So have you looked at this closely, John? What does the act entail?
It's a very short act. It's a pretty simplistic act. It basically just outlaws the manufacture, distribution, and resale of any sex doll that is shaped like a child or is intended to represent a child or looks like a child.
So it's concerned with the things outsides far more than its insides. It sounds like it's not concerned with its insides or
No, I mean, at the all. One thing as well I would say is that the actual title of the act, as you called it, the Creeper Act, I don't know why this is the case, but, you know, in America they love having these acronyms. And
yes, we
so
do.
So somebody, some intern, I guess, had to stay up all night coming up with that one. And it's not really about robots at all. It mentions robots as almost like a subclass of the device that it's concerned about. It's really concerned about dolls that look like children. And if they have a robotic element to them, it's also obviously concerned about them too. You know, that makes a certain amount of sense. It's as inclusive as possible.
Right. The motivations behind this act are, you know, viscerally not hard to understand. You have done some scholarship and have a paper up on your site on the topic, John, about outlawing virtual child sexual abuse, because I guess that's what we would call this. I guess the logic would be, even though someone's not engaging in an act that's hurting another human being, at some point society regulates and has the right to regulate things that we just consider flat out wrong, and engaging in even a simulated act of pedophilia would fall into that category. Can you flesh that out a little bit more for us?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Creeper Act, for example, it spends much more time on the intentions behind the act than the actual legal content of it. So the reasons for creating it. And the reasons for creating it is that they're concerned that it will normalize or encourage pedophilia in some way. And that's a fairly common concern about this type of technology, that it will somehow normalize, incentivize, embolden people who might otherwise be constricted or constrained by the lack of access to this form of sexual expression. The paper that I wrote that you referenced, it tries to make a different kind of argument, which is that even if there was no causal link between having sex with a child sex doll or child sex robot and real world instances of child sexual abuse, maybe there are still good grounds for criminalizing it. And there are a couple that I look at in that paper. One is maybe the classic one, is that it's somehow extremely offensive and problematic. And there are laws in the UK, for example, there's the Extreme Pornography Act, which outlaws things that are just deemed to be highly offensive, forms of pornography that are highly offensive, even if they don't cause harm to anybody. And that includes virtual child pornography. And or also the other ground that I think that you could use to to outlaw or criminalize this would be on the grounds that it's somehow harmful to one's moral character, or somebody who enjoys or likes using these devices is expressing some kind of defective moral character. Now, just to qualify all that, the paper that you reference as well doesn't make a definitive case for that view. It just outlines that as a potential argument. And one thing that I say in that paper that would qualify or change my thinking is that if it could be proven that using such a device actually has some kind of therapeutic or beneficial effect, maybe that would be a reason for allowing it in certain contexts. So there's a roboticist called Ronald Arkin who a few years ago caught a lot of flack for making this suggestion in a conference that maybe child sex robots should be used to treat pedophiles in the same way that methadone is used to treat heroin addicts. So, I mean, if you could prove that hypothesis, if that could be established, then maybe there would be a reason to be a little bit more open to the possibility of this technology. But until that's proven, I think we should be very wary about it. And I actually have a new paper, which probably coming out in the next few months, which argues that I'm not sure that we will ever prove such a hypothesis, or at least I'm very skeptical about whether we could prove that there is a beneficial effect. I think there are a lot of problems when it comes to the empirical study of therapy for child sexual abuse or pedophilia, that and problems in proving links between exposure to virtual child pornography or child pornography and real world child sexual abuse. So this is something that's been studied for a long time, and the actual effects of this are rather opaque or uncertain. And these are all reasons, I think, to be wary or doubtful about proving some beneficial impact of this technology.
Right. I'm very grateful in so many ways that we've had you on the show today. I think these are fascinating topics to delve into. But in this particular way, you've broken my heart just a little bit, that just to even learn that this, actually, you've broken my heart quite a bit to learn that these things are even being made. It seems like the way that they've come up in banning them so far, and again, I haven't read the CREPR Act yet, is more about their importation and sale than their actual manufacture. Am I correct about that?
So the CREPR Act will criminalize all activity related to the manufacture, sale, and purchase of these devices. Dan Donovan was the congressman that sponsored this particular act, and he was acting and at least advised by some people in the UK. So the Crown Prosecution Services in the UK had a number of cases last year, summer 2017, in which they prosecuted people for the importation of child sex dolls into the UK. I mentioned earlier on that they used an old act. I just looked it up there. It was the 1876 Customs Consolidation Act that banned the importation of obscene or indecent objects. And the CPS did this on the grounds that they thought there was a clear, provable link between the interest in these devices and the importation of them and other kinds of child sexual offenses.
Yeah. So once I get over my heartbreak of the fact that these exist, I come to the point of, well, of course they do. You know, if you can imagine it, the horrific thing, and there's a market around it, it's going to exist. And I guess that's something that lawmakers, regulators are going to have to bear in mind as these technologies progress and advance. That this, I guess, is just the the beginning of what could be far worse and weirder and harder to get your head around. Stefan, any thoughts?
Yeah, going into the paper itself, I thought it was really interesting, the case you laid out for what amounts to, I think you call it legal moralism, and the two competing or to some extent complementary justifications for legalizing or criminalizing things on the basis that they're simply wrong. And I believe it was Wall and Duff. They offered two theories on why that might be, that you could criminalize something simply on the basis of its immorality or its wrongness. And Duff's version in particular, which you get into, which this idea that something could be so morally incorrigible that it deserves public scrutiny and criminalization on its own account, struck me as interesting and also potentially amorphous in a way that could expand the scope of the legal moralism that you were trying to narrow in your paper. And I'm wondering if you could spend a little bit of time laying out that basic justification for criminalizing something that doesn't harm anybody other than arguably the person who's engaging in the conduct, and how a more sophisticated piece of legislation could address something like child sex dolls within a liberal paradigm of criminalizing moral wrongs.
Yeah, so this could be a long conversation or a monologue, so feel free to cut me off at any point if you feel like I'm rambling, which I no doubt will. Obviously, the traditional liberal paradigm since the time of John Stuart Mill is the notion that criminal law should only concern itself with acts that are harmful to other people. And legal moralism is usually associated with the counterpoint to that view, which is that you can concern yourself with other kinds of immorality that don't rise to the level of harming other people. Now, there are all sorts of problems around, you know, what is actually harmful to other people and how do you define the concept of harm. But let's assume that that's the case, let's assume that the use of child sex robots or child sex dolls is not harmful to others. Is there still a good ground for criminalizing them? So as you say in the paper, I set out two potential justifications for the criminal law concerning itself with acts that are morally wrong but not harmful to others. So Stephen Wall's theory, which is just that it's an act that is contrary to the moral virtue of the individual performing it, basically a kind of vice type justification or vice crime justification. And then Anthony Duff's argument that there are certain kinds of public wrongs, things that the community should concern themselves with, even if they're not harmful to other people, that are worthy of scrutiny. And I try to argue that both of those things, both of those justifications would apply in the case of child sex robots, that an individual that gets sexual gratification from a child sex doll is expressing or demonstrating a lack of moral virtue, and a particularly serious form of a lack of moral virtue. I wouldn't argue that all forms of morally vicious or non-virtuous action should be criminalized. People might argue that gambling or being addicted to gambling is not morally virtuous, or alcoholism is not morally virtuous. It's not obvious to me that even if that's true, that those things are not morally virtuous, and I'm perfectly willing to accept that they aren't morally virtuous, it's not obvious to me that the criminal law is the best way to address those problems. However, in the case of child sex robots, I think that the kind of lack of virtue here is sufficiently weighty or serious enough to warrant interference by criminal law, and that the criminal law might be an appropriate vehicle to use to address this problem. And that mightn't be that you criminalize people who purchase and use these devices, but that you might criminalize the manufacturer and resale of them. And this could be a kind of regulatory crime as opposed to a crime that attracts, you know, imprisonment or those more traditional forms of criminal sanction. I go into some of these issues in the paper, and I try to argue that it may not be as outlandish or ridiculous as people think it might be, or as some people might be inclined to think it is. And now your point that these concepts are a little bit amorphous and vague and ambiguous, that's true, but I think any standard that we use to criminalize conduct or actions is going to be a little bit vague and amorphous. It's not always going to be really precise what should fall within those boundaries. My argument would just simply be that child sex robots are kind of paradigmatic instances of this type of moral wrong. There might be other fuzzier cases on the penumbra or the shadow of these concepts, but I don't think that these kinds of devices are within that penumbra or shadow.
So the other thing that I think is fascinating to consider alongside this, and you do consider it alongside the pedophilia problem in your paper, is rape. Because the obviously there are going to be instances where one of these devices is used to play out those kinds of impulses as well. But that's not something that the lawmakers have chosen to wade into at this juncture. And so presumably you can, you know, have your way with your synthetic doll without any criminal legal ramifications. At least, you know, the U.S. isn't planning to ban those kinds of they're not planning to ban sex dolls because they can be used in ways that might not be morally provable, you know, morally okay if what the conduct were involving a human being. So what do you think about that distinction, John? Why don't you think lawmakers want to address rape, which is also obviously a terrible crime and a huge problem?
Well, so I think I may say that in say this in the paper that you refer to, and if I don't say it in that paper, I do say it in other things that I've written, which is that, again, the child sex robot case is just so kind of visceral and obvious, mm-hmm. and it's easy to define maybe what a child sex doll or robot is. It's just going to be something that looks and acts like a child. That it's probably easier to legislate for, and it's more immediately problematic or concerning.
Sure.
Because everybody objects basically to child having sex with children. So
hopefully, you know, everybody objects to rape. But I get your point on you can't, you know, you could have a pleasant, healthy relationship with your sex doll, I suppose. Or we can get into that in a moment too. And you could have one that would be less societally blessed.
I think everybody objects to rape, but I think there is much more controversy around the definition of what counts as rape, as we are mm-hmm. seeing played out constantly. You know, what counts as consent to a sexual mm-hmm. act? What kinds of signals count as consent? Or what kinds of signals allow somebody to make or form a reasonable belief as to somebody consenting? All these things play out when it comes to human-to-human interactions. And I think they're also equally problematic when it comes to robots. You know, can a robot even consent? There are some people who argue that the act of having sex with a robot is always rape. There are mm-hmm. a couple of, you know, feminist scholars of law. Cinziana Gutiu was one of them who wrote about this a few years ago, and also Kathleen Richardson, who's the leader of something called the Campaign Against Sex Robots in the UK, has made this claim that it basically having sex with a device that always consents and or is, even if it's switched off and it's always willing to have sex with you, is a kind of rape. So they argue that extreme definition that all sexual acts with a robot or a doll are rape. In the paper, I offer a more intermediate view, which is that I think that there is a kind of act which you could call rape of a robot, where the robot signals non-consent or acts as though it's not consenting, and that it might be playing up to some rape fantasy that somebody mm-hmm. has. And again, at the other side of the spectrum, there are people who say that, well, the whole notion of robotic rape is meaningless because since robots can't consent, you can't harm them by engaging in non-consensual sexual activity with them.
Right. It's a similar question to the is it prostitution question. No human is involved. And so does it even fall yeah. within the law? Where was I going to go with this? I want to get into your virtual sexual assault paper in a moment.
Can I just say one more thing about
yes,
the robotic
absolutely.
Rape scenario? So that's why I think people haven't touched upon the rape scenario, because I think it's more controversial and uncertain. Mm-hmm. Even though I do discuss it in the paper, there was an op-ed in the New York Times by Laura Bates, which made this case that one of the first prototype sex robots, which I mentioned earlier on, was the Roxy device, which I'm a little bit agnostic as to whether it exists. But if you go to the manufacturer's webpage, they mention that Roxy has a number of personality types, and one of the mentioned personality types is called Frigid Farah. And the description on the webpage says that if you make some sexual advance towards Frigid Farah, she won't be appreciative of your actions. And there's a suggestion or a hint there that this robot will be signaling non-consent, that they don't want, they're saying no, or they're resisting your sexual advance. So the argument that Laura Bates makes in that op-ed is that this would be a kind of, if you have sex with Frigid Farah after she has signaled resistance or unwillingness to have sex, this is a kind of robotic rape. And the op-ed goes on to argue that that's a highly problematic feature of the of this technology.
Right. Do you know how this has played out in the video game arena? Obviously, child pornography is child pornography, and it's not allowed in any format. But it seems to me, you know, again, that not from personal experience, but sort of anecdotally, that video games have been a little bit more lax about a realm where sexual assault could be played out in a virtual way with just the player and the game interface. We'll get to discussing player on player assault in a moment, where that can play out, and it's something that's already happening. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's a huge conversation or discussion about this when it comes to our different attitudes towards different kinds of virtual act. But there have been a couple of video games which have basically centered around the idea of raping virtual representations of characters. So people who came of age in the 80s and were video game fans may remember a game called Custer's Revenge, which had a very short shelf life, but the whole purpose of that game was you controlled basically a naked representation of General Custer, who went across screen fighting off Native Americans, and at the end of the level, the purpose of the game was to rape a Native American woman who was tied to tied to a post. So that's one example. There's also a Japanese game in 2006 called Rapelay, at least that's the translation of the title, in which the purpose of the game was to rape a mother and her daughters or something like that. And game was banned in most Western countries and European countries, although I think it was still possible to purchase it online and import it. It's a little bit before my time. So these things have happened, and there has been opposition to them. When those two games, there was a lot of opposition to them. But there are, I think, I haven't played video games in a long time, but you know, there are instances that are on the borderline of that, as far as I understand, in games like GTA. There are things that are approaching sexual assault that are part of the game.
Yeah, that's kind of what I had in mind, and I'm blaming myself for asking you the question that just told us about the Japanese game and the Custer game. Okay, so let's leave aside, you know, countries will decide, states will decide how far you can go in a virtual environment where it's just you and some simulation that doesn't involve another person. It's code. But your paper on the law and ethics of virtual sexual assault presents a different scenario and sort of gives the history of how that has played out over time, where you're not just interacting with code, or the person in the game is not, but with another player. And so give us that history that you give at the beginning of your paper, and sort of set the stage that way.
Yeah. So, I mean, here we're talking about actions that are performed on virtual representations of characters, like on avatars of characters in some virtual environment. So, you know, I was first alerted to this back in maybe 2015 or 2016, when a journalist called Jordan Bellemere wrote about her experiences playing a game called Quiver on the, I don't know if it was the Oculus Rift, or it was one of those virtual reality headset platforms. And the purpose of this game is that where you attack zombies with a bow and arrow in a virtual environment, and it's a multiplayer game, so you can interact with other people. And they all have on-screen avatars. And as far as I understand, the avatars are, they're not fully fleshed out or filled out human beings. It's basically a head and a shoulders with a bow and arrow. So it's not a full human form. That's somewhat significant for the story that she tells, which is that she was playing this game in her living room. trying out the device for the first time and was impressed by the capabilities of it. And then one of the other players in this multiplayer platform came over to her and started to grope the area where her breasts would have been in the real world, and then started chasing her around the virtual environment and tried rubbing the area where her groin would be if there was a representation of that in the virtual environment. And eventually she had to switch off the game or take off the headset to escape from that scenario. So she described this as a virtual sexual assault. And other women described similar experiences on Twitter after she reported that incident. Then it turns out, of course, that when I researched this, there's a much deeper history of virtual sexual assault, which I wasn't fully aware of. So back in the early 90s, a journalist called Julian Dibble wrote a paper in something called The Village Voice. I don't know if it's still existing. It was a magazine, which he was titled A Rape in Cyberspace, which described a scenario that took place on a virtual world called Lambda Mu, which is a purely text-based virtual world where people create avatars and characters and then they converse with one another and have various adventures in this online world. And a scenario or something happened where one of the characters in this virtual environment wrote something called a voodoo doll program, which allowed him to take control of other players' avatars and then depicted them engaging in various kinds of sexual acts with one another. And Julian Dibble was a member of this virtual community, and he interviewed the real-world people whose characters were taken over, and they described how traumatizing an experience it was, and he described this as the world's first virtual rape. Also, the virtual world or platform Second Life, which is still in existence as far as I'm aware, but it was more popular maybe in the mid-noughties or early 2000s. There were a number of cases of virtual rape on that platform. So it was like a step up from Lambda Mu. It's not text-based, it's actual 3D human-like avatars navigating through a fairly complex and detailed virtual environment. And there were instances of people, again, writing these voodoo doll programs that allowed them to take over another player's avatar and depict them engaging in unwanted or non-consensual sexual acts. And there was apparently a case in which the Belgian police investigated an alleged rape in Second Life. I looked into this a little bit at the time, and I could find reporting on the investigation and the mention that the investigation was taking place, but I could not find any follow-up to it or any outcome of that particular case. So those were kind of three historic instances of virtual sexual assault that got me interested in this topic and started me writing that paper.
Right.
And I wasn't the first academic to do so as
well. We've been doing this show long enough that we definitely covered the virtual reality one in 2015, probably not long enough to have covered the Second Life one when it occurred, but I think we've at least danced around that issue. So, have you encountered any regulators, lawmakers who have come in and said, "Yeah, we're going to do something about this"? It seems like it's more up to the platform at that point to have user and community guidelines that would prevent that kind of activity. That you would need that. You would get that first.
Yeah, and there was some suggestion that on Second Life there was some kind of community norms or standards in relation to this. Mm-hmm. Like some people enjoyed or liked the idea of acting out rape fantasies, so there were legitimate circumstances in which you could do it, at least according to those community norms, mm-hmm. which there are some chat rooms which discuss this idea. There's conceptual problems or conceptual issues with that. I think that the idea is that somebody consents in advance to somebody else constructing a voodoo doll program that takes over their avatar. Well, then maybe it's not sexual assault if there's a previous consent to this idea, although there are other issues around that then, about rape fantasies in the real world and how people can or cannot consent to them. I don't know of any specific laws or attempts to create specific laws to deal with these scenarios. One thing I do discuss in the paper, though, is that there are probably many ways in which existing legal offenses can cover these kinds of scenarios, insofar as they can probably be classified as maybe forms of sexual harassment or other types of sexual offense. So I discuss one case in the UK, which every law student in the UK covers, which had to do with a sexual assault through a webcam. And it involved a chat room as well. So it wasn't that people could see each other and were interacting directly with each other through the webcams. They were interacting through a chat room, and then one of them told the other one to perform a sexual act through the webcam. It turned out that it was the father of somebody, so an ex-boyfriend of somebody's daughter. He impersonated the daughter or another woman on this chat room and got the ex-boyfriend to engage in a sexual act via the webcam. And that was prosecuted successfully in the UK. And I kind of argue that that could be a model for many of these cases.
Yeah, your paper makes the point that if a virtual act hurts someone in real life, then, you know, then an assault has arguably taken place, and we have anti-assault laws, and people can be prosecuted. And that reminded me of the fact that we've covered on the show several times the case against. Now I need to pull it up so I can get the people's names. But the case against the guy on Twitter who attacked a journalist on Twitter. The journalist was a known epileptic, and the fellow sent a strobing light that was meant to cause a seizure. The journalist's name is Kurt Eichenwald, and the perpetrator is John Rain Rivello, and this is playing out in Texas. There were federal assault charges pending against him that were dropped, but there is an aggravated assault with a deadly weapon charge still pending in Dallas County. And that charge also carries a hate crime enhancement, sentencing enhancement. So that seems to me the most concrete example. It doesn't involve a sexual crime, but of somebody deciding to use an online platform to try and hurt someone in the real world and facing the consequences of that action. Stefan, what do you think of all this?
As I was reading these papers, I thought back to my initial experience with various video games in the 90s, and I'm not much of a video game player anymore, but when I was a kid, like a lot of kids, I played Wolfenstein 3D, and that, you know, that was a game where the premise was you walk around killing Nazis, and there didn't seem to be anything morally problematic about killing a Nazi. You know, as a 10-year-old boy, there's nothing more evil I could imagine than a Nazi, and the thought of having an opportunity to virtually kill one was nothing seemed amiss. There was another game that was popular at the time called Doom 2, which was similar to Wolfenstein, but it was sort of in the monster realm. And that similarly didn't feel particularly troublesome to me because it didn't have any signifiers of real life. There was a third game that came out around the same time called Duke Nukem, and that was the first game that I think edged into killings and sort of violence that were being inflicted on people who had analogs to people you might meet on the street in your ordinary life. And I distinctly recall feeling very uncomfortable in that situation because one of the, you know, characters, you know, involved some sort of slapping of a woman. I can't remember exactly what the scenario was, but there was sort of physical violence being directed at a virtual woman by this character. And I recall playing the game with a couple of friends, and some of them thought this was really, really funny and sort of reacted to it as though this was entirely harmless. And I remember having a very strong reaction to that at the time because I thought, well, this is quite different in kind from you know, Wolfenstein 3D or Doom 2. And it sounds maybe like hair splitting, but I think one of the interesting things about John's paper on this topic was that there are moral consequences to some of the adjustments that you can make in the factual scenario in these virtual worlds that could actually be impactful both as a matter of morality and also as a matter of law. And I think thinking about the various gradients of virtual representation of violence and what they say both about the person who made the game and also the person who's playing it and enjoying it is fraught with judgment and to some extent scrutiny of other people's desires and motivations. But I think it's a worthwhile exercise, and I think it demands a level of attention to how the virtual representation maps to the current legal framework that's intended to govern real life, so that we can think in a sophisticated way about what the consequences should be in the virtual environment. And I thought that was really interesting for the way that John drew that out in his papers, and to think back on my own experiences with some of these games.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting, just to jump in, that this is the first time we've brought up the fact we've been talking about sort of sexual activities in the virtual world. This is the first time we've brought up murder, that, you know, the one of the worst crimes you can think about in all of the human panoply, and murder in one way or another is the stock and trade of video games. And in various courts have found that there's a free speech right to that. In California, we had that happen. And so it's, I guess my overlay on that is that we have, it's so a part of that world that it's not taken seriously. And you do have both instances where you're merely murdering a bit of code and you're murdering other players, but they spawn back to life. And, you know, and it's not murder with a capital M, I guess, in that arena. What do you think, John?
Yeah. One of the things I tried to do in that paper is I tried to make a number of distinctions that I think are important in this debate, because people often run together or conflate different scenarios. And we're doing that a little bit in this conversation. So I'd just like to maybe draw back up for a moment and maybe distinguish between them, some of those cases. So,
sure, yes.
You know, one of my points in that paper is that this notion that there is some kind of hermetic seal or distinction between what happens in a virtual environment and what happens in the quote-unquote real world is a problematic idea. In fact, there's much more fluidity between the virtual and the real. And in fact, that in many cases, that distinction between what's virtual and what's real is meaningless or breaks down completely. You know, to just use a simple example, the kinds of transactions you perform online using money, that's kind of virtual in a way, but it's very real to you. The numbers that you're changing in your bank account or that you're sending to Amazon or whatever when you're purchasing something, they're virtually represented, but they're also clearly real. So one of my points about the virtual sexual assault or virtual assault more generally is that when you've got humans on either end of the virtual environment, they just happen to be interacting with one another through a virtual medium. Then in those cases, many of our existing legal categories and concepts can apply to them. You know, people are very keen to create special laws to deal with cyberbullying and cyber harassment. And I understand why they create those special laws. But it's not always obvious to me as to why they're necessary, because they are just basically forms of bullying and harassment that happen to occur through a virtual medium. So that's just one point. So when this notion that there's some significant difference between what happens on a virtual environment and what happens in the real world is, I think, problematic, particularly in cases where it's just basically two humans interacting with one another. The more problematic scenario, more maybe philosophically interesting scenario, is when you're dealing with a human being that's interacting with a virtual character, or a virtual character that's interacting with a human being, or in cases where there's seemingly more distance between what is happening to you in the real world and what's happening in the virtual environment, that the virtual environment is some kind of fantasy realm, as it is in many of these online platforms like Second Life or in computer games like World of Warcraft or whatever. Those tend to be the more difficult cases because of this notion of separation between what's happening to the real physical you and what's happening to the you in the virtual environment, or what's happening, what the real physical you is doing to a virtual character in a virtual environment. So that's just, I think, an important set of conceptual distinctions that are worth bearing in mind here. And now definitely, I can't remember what your question was. So
I guess my question, I don't know that I had a question. It was more of an observation about the fact that...
Murder versus sex, basically.
Exactly. Murder versus sex. And you know, the ubiquity of murder in virtual environments. And there are a lot of people who say that's very bad and should be outlawed. And it's contributing to the downfall of society. But the fact remains that it's ubiquitous. And I'm just wondering what you think about that from a legal philosophical standpoint.
It's very obvious that we have this double standard when it comes to virtual acts of violence versus virtual acts of sex or something equivalent. And we have a double standard in many ways when it comes to violence in media versus sex in media. There tend to be surprisingly more restrictions when it comes to the depictions of sex as opposed to the depictions of violence and films and so forth. I don't know. I've kind of batted this issue around a number of times. I don't know if I can come up with a credible explanation or moral justification of that distinction. It's certainly the case that for me, I often feel less unease when it comes to, let's say, a virtual murder or virtual physical assault as opposed to a virtual sexual assault. I tend to take the latter more seriously than the former. I don't know if I have a good reason for doing that. One of the arguments I make in the paper is that there might be something going on there insofar as murder or physical assault requires some kind of harm to the biological entity, whereas sex or what one's sexuality is a much more nebulous idea that may not require direct biological interference or contact, even though many legal jurisdictions define it as such.
I think that's a really valid point.
For people who are interested in this topic, I just want to make one point, and this is the last thing I'll say. There's a paper by a philosopher called Morgan Luck. It's a very short paper. It's called The Gamer's Dilemma, where he discusses this as a moral dilemma. He said the idea in the paper is that if you think that virtual child sexual abuse, for example, should be outlawed or prevented, then you really should have the same attitude towards virtual murder. And if you don't, then you've got some work to do or explaining to do as to why you don't treat them.
I'm with you. Okay, two more questions on this before we move on to the consent issue that you raised earlier, John. My first question has to do with what we're sort of dancing around right here, and that is the notion that, and we've already talked about lawmakers' abilities to regulate things that are just that are deemed to be a societal wrong. And my sort of intellectual framework for this question comes from a Netflix series that was recommended to me by one of the listeners to the show that is called Altered Carbon. Have you seen it, John?
I have seen it. I read the book that is based on a number of years ago as well.
Right. I forgot that it was based on a book. I haven't read the book. But one of the things that comes through loud and clear, and I assume it does in the book as well, is this notion that society, if you tweak enough things about society, such as put people in a body that is constantly renewable and make them incredibly old so that they've become jaded and constantly seeking more new and ever more problematic stimulations. That at some point, things that look like a little paper cut now can become death by a thousand paper cuts to society if they're allowed to proliferate, I think is one of those themes in that story. And I'm wondering, if this sex robot discussion is right in that wheelhouse, because it seems to me, and I'm sure that there are people doing scholarship on this, that is conventional, romantic, healthy, what we would consider traditional relationships with actual human beings become displaced by some of these robotic companionship interactions, that there will be social harms that, may be starting to play out now and may play out big time as things go forward. I'm thinking of sort of psychological, emotional, as you mentioned, damage, possibly actual physical issues, maybe as much as, you know, are we going to run into a population growth issue a la, let's bring in The Handmaid's Tale if folks are not actually deciding to have biological relationships with each other. Is there a role here for lawmakers and regulators to be thinking about those kinds of problems, John?
Well, it's kind of like a floodgates argument or a slippery slope type argument that, if we don't do something now, there's all these potential things that could happen. There's lots of interesting work being done speculating on what the potential implications of robotic sex technology or the technology of sex more generally. Viewers of this show will probably be familiar with the TV show Futurama and the famous episode where the lead character Fry falls in love with his Lucy Liu bot, and he's made to watch this public service video which shows him the terrible consequences of falling in love with a robot, which is just that civilization will crumble because no one will leave their room anymore because they'll have all the sexual gratification they could possibly want on tap. So there's no need to try to prove yourself in society through, you know, business or sport or science or art or literature or anything like that. And you know, that's an extreme view, but there are people with a similar view that is less extreme. And I don't want to maybe go on about it for too long, but the book that I have, there's a chapter in that about the effects that robotic sex technology will have on marriage and intimate relationships. The arguments within that chapter suggest that it might normalize non-monogamous relationships, that it might actually improve the quality of marriage because marriage becomes less about sex and more about companionship and intimacy because people have other outlets for their sexual gratification. There are obviously issues of that argument, which may occur to you, but that they're mentioned in that paper. And there's also an article which has maybe an unfortunate title. I don't know. I don't know if I want to say the title on this show. I don't know how family friendly this show has to be, but it's in a magazine called Jacobite. It's written by Diana Fleischman, who is an evolutionary psychologist, and she's written about the impact of robots on our evolved sexual psychology and makes a number of interesting claims. I just actually spoke to Diana on my podcast that I have as well. So if people are interested, they can follow that debate down. So if you look at those claims that are made there, you could say there are a number of issues that are coming down the line that we might want to step in and address now.
Right. I mean, I suppose the same arguments could be applied to pornography and have been applied to pornography over the years. But something becomes more compelling about the scenario when there is a physical manifestation of the thing, you know, in the room with you. The other question I had to do, getting back to the AI piece, is we're talking about crimes and rights and harms. Again, getting to the point where gazing into the crystal ball, there will be a time when we consider artificially intelligent things, not just bits of code. And I'm just wondering, you know, how you've spun out the criminal side of this as it comes to sex robots.
Yeah, I guess my view is that if robots reach a level of kind of human equivalence in intelligence or personhood, actually a lot of the ethical and legal questions become more straightforward insofar as you start to apply more human standards to them. That said, there are people who disagree with that view. And again, just to mention one of them, Steve Peterson is somebody who has written in defense of the idea of creating robot slaves on the grounds that if you create a being, even if it's a person, even if it is human equivalent in its experiences of the world, if you design somebody who really, really wants to do a particular thing, like the ironing or like have sex with you all the time, it's okay to do that because they're just satisfying their most preferred thing. So it's a controversial argument, but there are people who make that type of claim as well.
Wow. All right, Stefan, so anything you want to explore or add before we move on?
I think what you were gesturing at there a moment ago is this notion of like teleological purpose. And if somebody is achieving the thing that they're best for, why should we stand in the way of that? I wonder to what extent you can maintain that argument under circumstances where you're aware of the design of the person and the code. It's a slightly different, it strikes me as different morally from allowing a person to discover their own potential and pursuing it to its fullest extent versus trapping somebody in a very linear path-dependent life cycle where people outside of them have access to their psychology and understand the narrow path that they're on. And the person experiencing, or the robot in this case, experiencing that path has no insight into why they were coded the way that they were. So I think it's a great illustration of both the potential and the limits of ethical and moral concepts that are derived from assumptions of personhood as they're applied to entities that do not share that assumption. So that's one point. The other quick question I had was, in your ethical behavioralism that you've articulated, there's a focus on human sophistication. And I wonder how your framework is impacted by humans who don't achieve the same level of sophistication as advanced robots. So, for example, humans who, due to circumstances at birth or accidents that impact their brain function, end up in a vegetative state or in some other incapacitated state, nonetheless retain personhood as we understand it, both morally and under the law. So I wonder to what degree your ethical behavioralism is sort of a contingent one, in the sense that it assumes a level of sophistication is necessary for robots, but doesn't hold that same level of sophistication as necessary for humans to achieve an equal amount of personhood. So I'm wondering if you could probe that a little bit.
Yeah, so I would say stay tuned insofar as I have a paper that addresses this question directly. But I mean, to kind of preview it here, I think there are two options for me in defending ethical behavioralism. Either I kind of bite the bullet and say that, well, actually, it's not necessarily that sophisticated a type of behavior that you have to demonstrate in order to have legal or ethical personhood. And, you know, maybe robots will be crossing that threshold very soon if you compare them to... I use the example of animals or humans with some kind of severe disability in the paper. The other argument you could make, which is probably the one I would be more inclined to make for the time being, is just that behavior matters for ethical status, but it's not the only thing that matters. So one thing that might matter as well is whether you are a member of the human species or whether you're a biological entity. My view is that those might be less important grounds, and if an entity is sufficiently behaviorally sophisticated, the fact that they're not biological or they're not a member of the human species, those factors can be discounted in granting them ethical status. But the fact that a severely disabled or impaired functionality human is still a human and is still biological is a reason to favor it or bestow the status of personhood on it. So, kind of briefly summarize it, is that humans in that state will tick two boxes, that they have reasonable sophistication in their behavior or some degree of functionality in their behavior, but they're also members of the human species. The problem for robots that don't have sophistication in their behavior is that they don't tick that other box, if that makes sense.
It does. And I think that you've given us our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. It's going to be attaining personhood status. Hopefully all of us are there. We'll see. the other thing I wanted to mention that I haven't mentioned yet is there are a whole bunch of good links, particularly John's papers that we've been referring to throughout the show today, his book as well. And we aggregate all those things for you because we've looked at them before the show and you may want to look at them too. There's a list over at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. We're on episode 432 and everything we've reviewed to do the show today is there for you. Let's move on and do our last topic for the show, which is going to involve overlaying some sort of app-driven contractual consent on sexual interactions. This is something we've discussed on the show before. In fact, we've had Michael Lissek on the show, I think, a couple of times. He is the person behind a couple of the consent apps that are available on the market, the No app and the, I think it's called the Consent app or the We Consent app. But that marketplace is not just Michael's products. There are several of them out there. One of them was written up in the New York Times just this week. So set the stage for us here, John. It seems as though these things have bubbled up in response primarily to sort of on-campus directives that try to curb sexual assault by requiring students to consent with each other in some way or suggesting strongly that that's a good idea. So these apps have popped up whereby people can sort of stop in medias res and say, hey, do you like what's going on? Yes, I do. Let's proceed and document that somehow. They've been, critiqued, and over the years and in your paper on the subject as well, they are critiqued, by not really being perhaps the appropriate manifestation of how consent should be given and being insufficient to actually address the situation at hand. Can you give us your thoughts on these things?
Yeah, I mean, as you say there, the impetus or motivation behind most of them is the switch towards affirmative consent standards on U.S. college campuses and elsewhere in the world as well. So the need for some clear, unambiguous signal of a willingness to proceed with a sexual interaction. And just to be very clear to anyone who's watching this, we're now talking about human-to-human interactions. We've moved away from the virtual and robotic worlds completely in this discussion.
Have we? Because as you mentioned before, you know, once we start to see personhood being attained in an artificial way, maybe these kinds of concerns become relevant there as well.
Yes, they would. But I suppose I'm just making the point that these things are currently being pitched at kind of human-to-human interactions, but they would, yes, be relevant in that more science fictional type scenario, which may not be too far away either. I'm quite critical of these apps, and I'm not sure that they will solve the problems that they are set out to solve. Very briefly, I have three main concerns about them. One is that I worry that they create these decontextualized signals of consent. That's a bit of a mouthful, but I think that whether somebody consents to a sexual interaction or not depends on a number of contextual variables and not just the fact that they have ticked a box to say, yes, I'm willing to proceed with sexual interaction, or that they've recorded a video message saying, yes, I will have sex with you. Philosophers like to distinguish between the semantics of something and its pragmatics. So semantics is basically the conventional meaning of a phrase or a term or a sentence or maybe even a behavior. And the pragmatics is the meaning that this signal takes on in a particular context. So just to give an illustration, you know, one of the examples I use in the paper is that saying, yes, I will have sex to you, yes, I will have sex with you means something very different if the sentence immediately before that was, what's the least likely thing you're going to say this evening? You know, so it takes on a very different meaning.
Right.
And that's a silly example, maybe, but the more serious concern when it comes to consent apps is that they extract a short decontextualized signal of consent, and they don't have information about that broader context in which it was said, and something could be missing from that, such as whether the person felt threatened or coerced, or they were lacking capacity, or maybe they said it in jest and then it's used against them at a later point in time to suggest that they really did consent to sex. And there are enough problems that we have when it comes to ascertaining what happened in sexual assault cases there are problems around the so-called he said, she said dynamics of them. That I worry that adding this in is going to create more problems, because there's a danger that decision makers will latch on to this signal that they have that's been recorded and stored and encrypted or whatever. And the only information they have about that broader context is coming from the testimony of the witnesses, but there's more uncertainty about that because there's dueling testimony or disagreement. So they'll focus on the one thing that is tangible and real, like the way in which they latch on to, you know, forensic evidence or DNA evidence, because it's more real to them than the testimony of witnesses. And this could have a negative impact on decision making in sexual assault cases.
Right.
So yeah, that's probably my main concern about these apps. Just one other thing.
Yes, please.
Just one other thing is that you might say, well, we can solve that problem by adding in more of the context, maybe by recording more of people's sexual interactions. But then I think that then gets us into the issues around sexual privacy, what do people really want to share and feel comfortable sharing? And right. Also, to be honest, there are probably real-world cases of sexual assault and rape where you could have a complete video recording of what happened and it would still be ambiguous or uncertain as to what, or there would be room for disagreement about the interpretation of what happened.
Yep. A couple of interesting tidbits from this New York Times article. Dr. Morbius in IRC chat with us during the show here as we record is asking if he needs to bring his lawyer on a date when the date transpires. And that's a logical question to ask. And it's a particularly poignant question to ask in Sweden, apparently, which has proposed a law. I don't know if it's passed it. That requires people to get explicit verbal consent before sexual contact, period. We're not talking about a university environment. We're not talking about, you know, any sort of more smaller segment of society. We're talking about society at large in this law, as I understand it from reading this New York Times piece. So the app that they're profiling there is called Legal Fling, which sprang up in response to that kind of law as a way to accomplish what it might require. This was proposed last December, so I have not done the research, and the New York Times does not say whether it's still pending or not. But that seems to be a pretty broad approach to this problem taken by a state and worth monitoring. The other thing that's worth mentioning too in this article is apparently, if you think this is just pretty out there, but worth pondering, so do the makers of Black Mirror, because apparently the episode, which I have not seen yet, called Hang the DJ, involves someone doing a similar kind of consent transaction in the episode. Stefan, you were not around when we recorded the episodes with Michael Lissick. Have you read about these consent apps before, and have you had any thoughts about them?
I have read about them, and about when I was in college, we learned about the Antioch principles, which is also an affirmative consent principle that circulated at Antioch College, I think, in 1990. And at the time, in 1990, it was sort of unique and mocked. And then by the time, 2003 or so rolled around, it had spread much more widely and people were taking it more seriously. And now you see it's gotten all the way up to the legislature in Sweden. And I think it's a concept that people react to very strongly and sometimes sarcastically. And I think that's unfortunate, because if you think about what's at sort of the heart of the issue, they're trying to empower people to think about consent as an important aspect of sex. And I don't know why that elicits such hostility from people. It's just baffling to me. I understand that there are corner cases, of course, where you can end up with people's genuine rights being violated in some way by false testimony. I don't think anybody's discounting that. But I think as a basic premise, I mean, the point of these laws or at least policies, I'm not quite sure what the details of the Swedish one are, but typically what the point of it is to minimize non-consensual sexual activity. And I don't know why that elicits such hostility from people. And I hope people probe their thoughts on that and kind of come out with a with a good explanation for why there's so much.
Yeah, I can hazard a guess at that. I think the appification and the, you know, critiques of the appification of the process that John's already described and that he describes in his paper are part of it, that you simply can't reduce, you know, that complicated moment to moment interaction between people to something in an app, or even, you know, the app suggests that it's some sort of contractual kind of situation, but I don't think anybody would think that that was an enforceable contract. There are certain things that you can't reduce to contractual form, and I think this would fall within it. But what
I wasn't so much commenting on the apps themselves. Like, I think the apps are fairly unsophisticated at addressing the problem. I meant more broadly what the apps are driving at, and I think what a lot of these discussions are driving at, is this notion of taking consent and making it a more central aspect of the discussion around sex. And I think that in itself is generally positive. I think the apps are probably a clumsy way to address that. And in fact, reading into, I think it was John's paper, some article that I read yesterday, it highlighted that some of these apps seem, if anything, to be directed at solving the ex post problem of, you know, if sort of helping the person who's been accused prove that they in fact had consent, and maybe it's a fairly clumsy way at doing that. So the apps, from what I've read about them, from what I've seen about them, they seem quite clunky and not terribly well suited to addressing the problem.
Right. And Michael Lissick, one of the creators of a suite of these apps, is the first person to say, and he said it on the show, that we don't really intend for this to be anything other than, as you say, Stefan, a discussion prompt for the people involved so that they wind up having that conversation. But it winds up, as you say, being clunky and probably, you know, designed at least in part to react to the fact that the reason we see these things in the college marketplace is because, as the New York Times points out, California became the first state in 2014, and others have followed suit, that require colleges to use affirmative consent as the standard in disciplinary decisions. So if there's something goes awry and you have to demonstrate your consent, if you have something to look at on the phone and say, well, you know, we did talk about this and here's the record of it, you have something to toss into the mix. Of course, it's problematic, you know, what was consented to and whether the consent was ongoing, et cetera, et cetera. So a perennially interesting topic, and it's great that you're looking at it and writing about it, in addition to all the other things that we've looked at today in connection with your authorship and scholarship today. John, do you have any final thoughts on the consent piece before we go ahead and wrap up the show?
Just maybe two comments. One is that I agree with Stefan in that when it comes to the idea of, you know, affirmative consent standards and that people should be having more explicit conversations about what exactly they consent to and that they desire, I certainly have no opposition to that. People say that these kinds of conversations would be mood killers or would kill the passion within a particular context, but or they'd be embarrassing to people. But I don't think those are good reasons to not have the explicit conversation if the harm of non-consensual sexual interaction is a very serious one, which I think most people are now being aware that it is, and they're more taking it more seriously as a kind of harm. So I don't have an issue with the move to affirmative consent standards. My critique is that these apps don't maybe address the problem most seriously. And the other thing I would say is that if the idea behind these apps is that they are to promote or encourage conversations around affirmative consent, then why do they have kind of permanent storage of the information and data that can be used in a proceeding or a criminal or tribunal of inquiry? Because I think that's one of the things that's problematic about them, the fact that they could be used as this kind of evidential threat towards people.
Yeah. Yep. And I think, you know, there's a market for them, I think, for that reason, even though there are other more societally beneficial purposes to the apps than simply providing defense in the effect of an accusation. All right, let us move on. People, a couple of funny comments from IRC. First of all, Caillou just said Thanos may have had a point after listening to the whole show today. Maybe half of us just need to go away, given what some of us are up to. And secondly, I forget who it was, begging for the animal selfie of the week just to have a palate cleanser after everything that we have discussed today. And I selected an animal selfie of the week with that in mind. One tip, though, it's not an animal. Let's go. I figured this week, in light of the fact we were going to do so much discussion of robots, we needed a robot selfie of the week. And since animals and robots maybe enjoy a similar sort of sentience rights status at this point in time, in some ways anyway, in the copyright arena anyway, we have a robot selfie of the week, fresh from the Mars. Well, not that fresh. It was earlier this year from the Mars Curiosity rover on Mars, taking a selfie of itself and reminding us that some robots do not engage in anything at all that's creepy or harmful to humanity. Some of them help us have knowledge and exploration and move forward as a species. So thank you, Mars Curiosity rover, for reminding us of that. Our tip of the week is also in keeping with our theme today. There is a British firm that is addressing the problem of the expense of the virtual robotic sex dolls and offering you easy peasy monthly payments. So if indeed you are interested in financing your robot sexual companion, at least one enterprising British sex firm and bank are making that possible for you. That's in our discussion points for today. I am throwing that out as a tongue-in-cheek tip at best. And then our resource of the week is going to be John Danaher's podcast, which we've already alluded to today. It's called Algocracy.
It's probably best just if they go to my webpage, Philosophical Disquisitions, there's a tab just says podcast and it's easy to find there.
Algocracy and the Transhumanist Project. Tell us about your show and sort of what people can expect if they decide to take a listen to some episodes and hopefully subscribe.
Yeah, well, if you're looking at the screen right now, you can see the most recent episode is with Diana Fleischman about evolutionary psychology and sex robots. I don't just talk about this topic. So it's mainly to do with technology and ethics and philosophy and law more generally. An awful lot of my discussions are around algorithmic decision-making and fairness and bias and those kinds of debates. I have also a recent episode about psychedelics and human enhancement and anything to do with technology, the future, and ethics are covered in the episodes.
Very, very cool. And of course, your book, which is called Robot Sex, Social and Ethical Implications, and is available on Amazon and elsewhere. John Danaher, it has been absolutely intellectually fascinating spending these couple of hours with you. We really appreciate your time today and your thoughts and insights.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. Thanks for listening to me. I apologize to everyone for the, plumbing the depths of human psychology here. But sometimes you do have to think and engage with the unthinkable. So,
absolutely, yeah, we do. And if you don't, you avoid it at your peril. So we're it was difficult at times, but it was good to have done it. Stefan Spida, thank you for coming along for the ride. Great to have you.
I'm very glad that I got to participate in this discussion. And just in case anybody was wondering, I did have a great Bolshevik anecdote, but I didn't squeeze it in this time. So well, 5 weeks running it could have been, but...
Squeeze away. We don't want to miss it.
All right. I'll make a very quick Bolshevik anecdote. I think earlier we were talking about the effects of having sex robots on marital life and sort of speculation about how that might impact society downstream. And what I was going to point out was every society that has ever imagined and tried to execute a utopia has started with the premise that there's something fundamentally broken about marital relations that need to be changed and reconstituted around the demands of the coming utopia. And mm-hmm. you can say the same thing about the Bolsheviks, and they sort of reimagined communal family life, or technocrats who imagine robots satisfying aspects of marital function such that the whole, bourgeois marriage will crumble and reconstitute itself around this technocratic ideal. And so decontextualized from this discussion, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but I wanted to make sure I got the Bolsheviks in one more time this week to keep that streak going. So there you have it.
Happy to have them on board. And yes, I get your point. Exactly. It's been really wonderful hanging out and having the conversation with you both and with all of you who have joined us today. If you've done so on a Friday morning at 11 o'clock Pacific time or 1800 UTC, then you've joined us live. Yay you. That's when we record this show and interact with our audience in IRC as we play along. But you don't have to listen to us when we record live. We record it and we make it available after the fact. And then it persists on and on for years and years. So someday when the robot sex dolls have taken over the planet, we will look back and see that we predicted that people should be paying attention to this and possibly scratching their heads about what should and should not happen. So that's available at twit.tv/twill, our whole archive of shows, as well as various suggestions and instructions for how you might enjoy the show on the device of your choice, be it a large screen or small, be it a podcast subscription format, or simply watching the video online or the audio as you go about your day. So very thrilled that you've joined us, however you've joined us. Please do keep in touch with us between the shows. I am Dee Howell on Twitter. Stefan, do you have a Twitter account that you're using at all that we should plug or no?
By next week, I will. I keep meaning Yay. To do it, and I keep forgetting to do it.
All right. Far be it that I rope you into social media against your will. You know, don't let that happen. Because you can also reach out to Stefan by email. We're tweaking the email settings behind the scenes. He hasn't been getting your Stefan at twit.tv emails, but we hope that he will be getting them soon. That is Stefan with an F, STEFAN. And I'm Denise at twit.tv. So please reach out to us there as well. Let us know any thoughts that you've had in response to this show, any insights that you'd like to share with us, any guests that you think would be great additions to our show. Happy to reach out to whoever you think would be wonderful to sit down and have a conversation with. We'd love to have all of your suggestions, including what other dystopian Netflix shows we should tune into to figure out how they impact or help us think about the events that we're dealing with in the world today. We will be back next week. Until then, please take care.